I'm Stacy Grinsfelder from Blake Hill House.
And I'm Devin Caldwell from Our Philly Row. We're the hosts of True Tales from Old Houses.
Hi, Devin. I'm back. We're back.
We're back. Yes. Welcome back. How was your vacation?
Oh my gosh, it was wonderful. I did write a blog post and made a YouTube video, so probably everyone who knows me is already tired of reading about it or hearing about it or seeing where we went. But for those of you who don't know, we did take a carefully socially distanced driving, masked up, sanitizing, using all the things. We made a car trip to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And if you have not been there, you, Devin, or anyone who's listening.
The UP. I have never been, actually. I've been close, but never actually on the Upper Peninsula.
I had no idea. Honestly, I had no idea. I just thought, okay, I've been to Missouri. I've been to Illinois. I've been to Ohio. All those middle states. It is beautiful. So if you call the UP your home, you are lucky people.
Yes, indeed.
It's just gorgeous. The colors. The thing I couldn't get over was the light. You know, the light changed throughout the day. You had beautiful morning light and then afternoon light and then evening. It made it look like a different place all day long. It was really incredible. I loved it. I really loved it. Long drive, very remote, no people. So it was kind of the perfect pandemic location.
Right.
I guess that's all I can say. It was nice to get away. And I recognize that that's both a luxury and a privilege to have that opportunity to get away. And it was helpful. It really was. I hope that if you have the opportunity to craft your own sort of staycation, that you are able to carve out a little piece of, I don't know, peace, a piece of peace.
Yeah.
That you're able to carve out a little bit of time for yourself that's away from the normal stress of pandemic life.
And you get to spend time with your family.
Yeah, that's true. Although I'm a little tired of spending time with my family. Have you really ever spent that much time with teenagers?
Personally, no.
No, they're lovely people. They're lovely people. I just want to shout out to everyone who may be struggling a little. I get it. It's not all sunshine and roses here every day. So while I was away, I believe you were working on a bit of a project yourself. Is that correct?
Yes. I've been working on the dining room and I've gotten it painted. And that's about as far as I've gotten. I installed a whole bunch of cabinetry, but the doors are not in stock. They're IKEA cabinets.
That's right. We talked about that last full episode that we were together. And I think it sounds wonderful.
It's going to be amazing. It's just right now, it's a large wall of open shelving waiting for cabinet doors. And hopefully they're in stock next week.
Yeah. On a scale of 1 to 10, how much does open shelving bother you?
Ooh. So I'm not a fan of open shelving. A little, maybe one shelf, yes. My biggest thing with open shelving is dust and dirt and grease. And, you know, unless you can't have anything in there that you don't touch for a few months, it gets disgusting, in my opinion. Just my opinion.
Interesting. Yeah, we have different thoughts. Not you and I. I think you and I have the same thought about open shelving, but many people have, it's kind of a love it or hate it sort of situation.
That's why I love glass cabinet doors, because you can still see everything, but the cabinet doors keep the dust and dirt out.
All right. Well, I guess we better move on to announcements. Do you want to start? Do you want to give the first announcement?
Sure. So this month, we are recording ghost story episodes to release in October. Every October, we tell fun and mostly lighthearted ghost stories. If you have a good one to tell and you're willing to be our guest, please reach out via the contact page on our website or via direct message on Facebook or Instagram.
We've done ghost story episodes for the past two falls, and it's been a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is.
We are also currently gearing up for a big merchandise run, and we are excited to offer True Tales from Old Houses merch during the month of October. Gosh, October's a big month for us, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
All right. So we're planning to take those orders in October. We will not charge your credit card in October. We will charge when they ship in November. And we hope that will make perfect timing for holiday presents.
It's going to be awesome.
Yeah. And we're currently, you and I are working on finalizing the products. And we plan to have a preview pretty soon because we realize, you know, you can't make a decision if you can't see it, right?
That's right. The 5th annual conference of the Window Preservation Alliance will be virtual this year. It is Saturday, October 3rd. We will put a link to that information on our website. The Window Preservation Alliance is a trade organization, but poke around their website, you might want to become a member.
I guess that's all we have for announcements this week. If you have announcements for us that you want us to share on future episodes, just send them our way and we'll be glad to.
Time for some Q&A. Today's question comes from Hannah from Philadelphia, my favorite city.
Oh, yeah, Philadelphia. Sounds familiar.
Yes, indeed. So she writes, first, I'll say that I'm in Philadelphia and winter is coming. I know there are a lot of window questions, but the previous owners added a very small addition to the back of the house, which I recently discovered is rotting a lot. Here are the highlights of the project.
Okay, so yeah, the highlights of her project are that Hannah... So there's this addition on the back of her house, and Hannah removed the aluminum replacement window from what was originally the back of the house. So my understanding is that the back of the house had a window, and then this addition is beyond that. It sounds like she'll be dismantling the addition, exposing the original back of the house with that current window opening. Now, she wants a wood window, but because the job is small, she's having a hard time getting companies to call her back. Or they're willing to book her, but it's way in the future, nothing right away. When the previous owners added the aluminum window, they also made the opening smaller. Right now, only the top pulleys remain. So here's her actual question. Why don't you tell us her actual question, Devin?
Hannah asks, should I try to cover the window hole with plywood, etc. for the winter and then book somebody a year out? Or should I try to find a salvage window, the kind that fits in the frame, and teach myself how to install it? Or should I figure out how to build a whole new window? I'm not a novice DIYer, but I am also not a woodworker.
Good question, Hannah. Thanks for sending it our way. I'm kind of obsessed with windows, so would you like me to answer what I would do, or do you want to answer what you would do? I mean, what are the considerations for Philadelphia? When does your winter come?
I think winter comes, well... It really starts in November. It's not, I mean, in my opinion, but, you know, I lived in Chicago for a lot of years, so I always wondered when winter was going to come.
So November, it's September now, so probably 2 months before you start getting uncomfortable with the breeze.
Yes, definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
All right. So that's when your heaters are going to kick on and you're going to start, you know, wearing coats and things like that.
You know what? Let's start that one again, because actually it should be October.
Well, we don't really have to start over because I was kind of like really dialing in on that exact day. I was looking for you to tell me November 12th at 1 o'clock, there will be winter.
No, I can do that for summer for Seattle, but I can't do that for winter in Philly.
Okay. You haven't lived there quite long enough. All right. Well, that just gives me some idea. Do you want me to go ahead and just answer what I would?
Sure.
Well, I mean, first of all, there's no reason why you cannot learn how to make a window by yourself. I think that the general cuts that you would make, the general tools that you would use, are not particularly difficult to learn and master. I will say not everybody has them. So if you're talking about one window and you have to buy a bunch of tools, then it may not really be worth it to take that route. Now, your second choice you said, or well, I guess I'm ranking these. I'm not intending to rank your choices. I'm just giving them in an order. You may choose the one that fits you the best. Okay, you could use a salvage window and install that too. That's perfectly reasonable. It might take some doing to find the exact window or a close enough approximation that will fit in the hole, you know, in the jam that you have left. I want to suggest that you go to the Window Preservation Alliance website, and we'll link that right over on True Tales from Old Houses. If you don't find it on Google search, you'll find it there. The Window Preservation Alliance, we just announced their annual meeting. They have a directory, and there are, I don't know, maybe 5 Philadelphia area window preservation companies, professionals. And I think that's who I would call first. I'm all for DIY. I do it all the time. But we're talking one window. Maybe it would be worth your time to reach out to these window restoration professionals and get an estimate on how much it would be to have them build a replica window for you and fit it into that jam. It might be a better use of your time. It might be less of a headache to just have this one window done by a restoration professional. As far as covering up the hole and when and where, I think plywood's a great option. Even double layer of plastic, if you choose to go the window professional route and you have someone come by and they book you, you know, 2 months, 3 months in advance, even a double layer of plastic would work really well. I think your main factor is safety. you know, where this window's located and keeping away from the elements. But those would be my suggestions. Do you have any other suggestions, Devin?
No, I think those are great. As far as the plywood goes, you know, if it needs to be longer term, because I know that some of these companies have a long waiting window because they're busy. But, you know, with the plywood, you also have the option of cutting a hole in the plywood and putting in a plexiglass window temporarily so that you can at least get some light in. And then covered in plastic, of course, to keep the draft out. But, you know, it's not exactly pretty. But if it's the back of the house, it's something you can live with for a while. It's actually how I would handle it.
I hope that helps you, Hannah, make a decision about what you want to do in your house. If this is not thorough enough and you have more questions, then please feel free to just send us another message and we'll answer it privately. And if it's useful information for a future episode, we'll just add it in.
Today's guest is a treat. Bill Chapman and his wife, Gay, have been doing restoration on Enon Hall, their 18th century family home in Virginia, for more than 20 years. Bill is known as the granddaddy of the blogging movement, having started blogging about it in 1999, before anyone even knew what blogging was.
Right. I mean, I'm not even sure it was called blogging then, right? I mean, wasn't it just an online journal or something like that?
Yeah, I think you're right. Their restoration journey has been featured in the likes of Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, on CNN, and many other media outlets. And while he has moved on from regular blogging, the restoration goes on, and he regularly posts updates on Instagram. Our conversation with Bill was such an absolute delight, we lost track of time and ended up with loads of content for you. With so much to share, we are breaking it up into two episodes.
I love a two-parter. Anyway, you are going to love getting to know Bill and the story of Enon Hall, past and present.
Hi, I'm Bill Chapman, and along with my wife, Gay, we are the owners of Enon Hall, which is an old family home in Virginia's Northern Neck, and we've owned it since 1999 and have been working on it pretty much nonstop ever since.
Excellent. It is such a pleasure to meet you, Bill. I'm so excited that you agreed to do this interview with Devin and I. It's really nice to have you here.
Likewise. Great to meet you all as well.
Your blog, basically when you started your blog in 1999, it was sort of considered the granddaddy of the house blog movement. And I love that. You wrote that. I read that yesterday on Enon Hall and it just tickled me. I thought it was really great. But you're right. I mean, did you use AOL back then? That's what it made me think of.
No, I think AOL had declined by then, but it was not a blog. That word didn't even exist yet. So when we first bought this house, I didn't know where to begin. So my idea was to have a website where I could post photos and find other experts who had already been down the road of historic preservation and be able to post a photo of here's the situation we're dealing with. I need some advice. Well, very quickly, and I did make some of those contacts initially, but then very quickly I started journaling. And I just called it the online journal. And again, this was 1999. Google wasn't prominent. The first photos that I posted on the website were taken with a film camera and scanned. It was a few months later when I actually bought a digital camera and it was terrible. And back then everybody was on dial-up. So the photos I was posting were tiny.
Right.
And if I go back to the website now, you know, I instinctively want to click on the photos and make them bigger. And no, they don't get bigger. They're tiny because everybody was using modems to access the website.
Right. Remember dial-up and the pictures, you know, and they'd come in sort of a line at a time and you'd wait for the pictures.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So then it became kind of a way to chronicle our experience. And I believe the first post was the day that we closed on the property. What I didn't expect to happen was for this community to form. And for all these followers to find out about our project and find out about the website, and over the years really become participants in the website. And then we started seeing, with more blogging software and so forth, we started seeing more folks starting old house blogs.
All right. Well, we'll get to the part where you built a community and people started to recognize you. But Devin, would you like to ask the first question?
Sure. Let's just start at the beginning. How did you end up in Enon Hall, and what's your connection to it?
So that answer begins in 1970. Honest to goodness, it begins in 1970 when I was 7 years old. And my grandfather, who was a Hathaway, who grew up in this area, he showed me this big fat book called Hathaways of America that had just come out. And in there was a very small photo of Enon Hall. And the caption was that William Hathaway purchased this home and so forth, and had been in the family for so many generations. And my name is William Hathaway Chapman. So as a seven-year-old, as a kid who was very interested in history, that just spoke to me and fascinated me that there was a house somewhere that had been in my family for that long. And at 7 years old, I said, one of these days, I'm going to buy that house back, which tells you a little bit about my personality, because we did, in fact, do that. You know, when I first met Gay, and even before I believe we were engaged, and that whole process was very short. I'd known her or we'd been dating for about 6 months when we got engaged and were married 6 months later. So, but it's somewhere in that process, I said, there's this house out there in Whitestone, Virginia, and someday I want to buy it back. And it's a mess. And she didn't run away.
She said, yes, please, let's go do that.
Well, actually, you know, so the house was owned by a couple who in 1999 were both 94 years old. And they had bought the house in the 60s, and they were already retired. And they had done some work on the house, and then it just absolutely got away from them and was completely overgrown and just a mess. They were pretty famous for chasing off descendants who came to the property to see the house or to visit the graveyard. I came here and would just quietly clean up the graveyard every once in a while. So Mr. Hayden, the husband, came to know who I was and came to trust me. And slowly we started to have conversations. And sitting on the screen porch, I first broached the subject of, you know, if you ever want to sell the place, I'd love to talk to you about it. Because I was convinced that anybody else would buy it and tear it down.
Sure.
That I was the only one in the planet that would save the house. And this is an area, it's a waterfront piece of property. This is an area where a lot of expensive houses are built along the water. So it would be a desirable piece of property for somebody. And he kind of pushed back and said, you know, I could never get the house cleaned up enough to show it. And he took me in one room in the house, and it was, there was a path wide enough for him to take his walker through. And I could see into the center hall passage and see that obviously nobody had been upstairs for many, many, many years, because the staircase was just covered. So it was a combination of, I think, somebody, the wife with hoarding tendencies, then had Alzheimer's and everything just compounded. I said, you know, I talked to Gay and I said, would we be willing to buy this house without going inside it?
Right.
I've seen one room. Gay had never stepped foot inside it. We stood outside and looked at the condition of the exterior and said, okay, you have to assume the inside is just as bad. Is this something we want to do? And she said, yes. Amazingly, she said, yes. And I can tell you, on that day when we stood there and had that conversation, you could look around the property and have no idea that there was water anywhere, because things were so overgrown. So it wasn't even a decision based on, oh, this could be such a beautiful piece of property.
Right location, perfect location.
Yeah. No, to her, it reminded her of her summers going down to Georgia and spending the summers in her grandmother's old house, and all the cousins would gather there. And that's what it spoke to for her. It spoke to an experience of a place to go with our son and nieces and nephews and recreate some of those experiences.
What a lot of trust you two had in each other to just sort of take this leap of faith. And Gay said yes, and you'd wanted it since you were seven and you'd seen one room. I mean, you knew what you were getting into. And I really appreciate the idea that you said the house just got away from them. I think that's a really respectful and important way to say that about people who've lived in these old houses for a very long time, because, you know, they're part of the story too.
And I appreciate that. And we were fortunate to have some overlap with Mr. Hayden as well. He had done a fair amount of work to the house when they first bought it. You know, because I wasn't able to ever walk through the house while he was still living there, we bought it with a life estate for the couple. So again, this was part of the deal. You can stay there as long as you can, as you want, as you're able. But we had purchased the home. She went into a nursing home pretty soon after we closed, and he lived there for almost another year. And we would come on the weekends and just start clearing out the property. And I think he really appreciated seeing some activity and some forward momentum. He told me that Mrs. Hayden, you know, she always said, if God wanted something to grow, who was she to cut it down? Everything grew.
Right.
And like he pointed us to one of our first discoveries. He said, there's an old brick walk out there leading to the Dutch colonial. And it had long since just been totally overgrown. And we were so excited to go out there and start digging away the turf and uncovering this brick walk.
Okay, so I've got a quick question and then probably a longer question. The quick question is, did you name it Enon Hall or was it always Enon Hall?
We did not name it. That name goes back to at least the 1870s. That's the earliest that I've found it in written records.
Okay. And then the long question is, I mean, obviously this house was not move-in ready. So how long did you work on the house before it was safe to inhabit?
So when we purchased it, again, with a life estate, Mr. Hayden lived here for another year. And then after he died, his executor spent months and months and months cleaning it out. So it was almost another 6 months after he died before we stepped foot in the house. I mean, and our intent at the time was not to inhabit it. Our intent was for it to be a weekend place.
Oh, I see.
But the biggest problem was the stink. It smelled terrible because they had, depending on who you ask locally, there were a lot of people tell you there were 60 cats living here. And apparently the cats had a wonderful relationship with all the mice and just let them live and do their thing. Step number one was trying to get the stink out of the house and worried that we would never be able to do that. I wound up tearing off everything from the 20th century except for our screen porch, because there were several shed additions onto the back of the house, the creek side of the house, that had really become animal places, and they were disgusting. And the more of that that I tore off, the more the smells started to dissipate. And, you know, we would show up Saturday mornings for the weekend and just brace ourselves opening the door going, okay, is it any better or is it worse? And it took a couple years. So initially when we stayed here, we slept on the screen porch. We couldn't even come in the house because just the odor and the filth was too much.
At this point then, did Gay sort of look at you now and then and say, oh, Bill, what have we done?
She should have, but she didn't. I've also always said that her patience is extremely elastic. She's a project person, as you can tell from our Instagram and from the website. She has always been, you know, roll up her sleeves and get in. And one of the first indicators that we had this potential as a couple was not long after we were married. I inherited an old sleep sofa and a wing chair from my grandmother, and they needed reupholstering. They looked terrible. And Gay looked at him and said, we can do that.
That's great.
And we worked together, and I very carefully took all the fabric off and made drawings of how it had been attached and affixed. And she used the old fabric as patterns to make the new. And then we, you know, put it all back together. And that was our first, she learned that from her father. She watched her father kind of had that can-do attitude. And I always joke, and it's not a joke, it's the truth. When we got married, she had way more power tools than I did.
So tell us about the history of Enon Hall itself. I know that the Dutch colonial portion is 18th century. So give us a little bit of a timeline of when Enon Hall and how it came along and how it was built out.
So my sixth great-grandfather, great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather bought the property in 1762. And at the time, it was called Andrews. It was 200 acres. And in the deed, it indicates that there was a dwelling and outbuildings here at the time. So we don't know exactly what that looked like. We believe that Andrews is incorporated into the base of the Dutch colonial. The house, you know, every 30 years, the house would change. A new generation, a new marriage, a new wife, you know, would say, well, I want another room. We want to build an extension. You know, just what happens today. So the house really didn't take that Dutch colonial form with the gambrel roof until probably 1800, 1805. And we believe at that time the smokehouse and the kitchen quarters were also built because they are exactly 40 feet away from each corner of the Dutch colonial, very symmetrical layout in the yard. And then, you know, there was an additional room built or a story and a half built in the 1850s. And then that roof was raised to create this room that I'm in now, which was used as a law office in the 1880s. So this room is actually Victorian, where other parts of the house are, you know, as the cellar is pre-Revolutionary War, then the Dutch colonial is more post-war, early 1800s. If you go upstairs where I'm working on a guest room or one of the bedrooms in the Dutch colonial right now, that's a remodel probably in the 1820s, again in the 1880s, and again in the 1970s.
That's very cool.
Even late 19th century, there was an L built out the back of the house that only seems to have been there for about 30 years. And I was told it was pretty poorly built, so it didn't last long.
So let's talk about the cemetery that you have on your property. I would love to hear more about the cemetery.
Yeah, so the graveyard has dates, or the markers have dates going back to, I believe the earliest one is the 1850s, and then go up to 1920. The wall itself was built around 1920. We had there are two giant English boxwood in there, and all of the grave markers are oriented along one wall, and then the other half, there are no markers. So we had a ground-penetrating radar study done last year to try to determine, is the other half of that graveyard empty, or are there disturbances in there that would indicate earlier graves? And it is definitely not empty. There are a lot of graves in there that are unmarked, which makes sense because there are generations who lived here who aren't represented by markers. So either they would have had earlier wooden markers that have long since disappeared. So it was a kind of a question, was when this wall was built in 1920, was it built around existing graves or was it allowing for room for growth?
Right, right.
Graveyard growth is a weird concept. But
yeah,
for additional inhabitants. So there are definitely additional graves in there. There is also the family story that's been passed down through the generations is that one of the enslaved people who lived here, a lady named Priscilla Fauntleroy, who I can find her going back into estate inventories going back to 1844. She was born around 1815 and died in 1887. Supposedly, she was so beloved that she was buried in the family graveyard. But of course, there's no marker there.
There's no marker, right? Part of our problematic history.
Yeah. So, and you know, you talk about problematic history. If you own an old home in the South, it is very likely to come with history. If that old home in the South happens to be your family's old home, then you're living with that history.
Right.
And, you know, for us, this has been such a learning process. I've often said that old houses, you know, if you pay attention, they're constantly teaching you something. And for us, you know, this has been an evolution from something that as a 7-year-old was a photo in a book that meshed with stories that my grandparents used to always share about living in this area. It was a romantic dream to own the ancestral home, and it was a very pure dream without any baggage or a very pure vision. But the more you start, looking around and realizing that, this was a plantation. This was what would be classified as a small to middling plantation, because at any given point between 1771, which is the earliest slave listing that I've seen in an estate inventory, to the Civil War, at any given point, there were between 16 and 24 enslaved people living here. When we first bought the place, we knew that one of the outbuildings was a kitchen. And several years later, there was an older African-American gentleman here who was helping to dig out our well, where the well had run dry. It's a hand-dug well. And anyway, he was here, and he immediately looked at the kitchen and said, "That's a slave quarters."
Wow.
And
yeah, it's hard. It's hard. You all right? Yeah. There's been a few times during this conversation where I felt a little teary, and this is really emotional. And so how about, you can't change the history that you inherited, but you're now part of Enon Hall's story in a new way and in a different way. So are there things that you've chosen to do as the storyteller, the current storyteller, that are different? Or what are you doing differently as the current storyteller? Because I know there are some things you're doing differently.
Yeah, this has been something that, as we learn more and more about the history of the house and the family and slavery in general, and, it's been an eye-opener. I think I have only recently, and I posted it on Instagram because it felt like a marker for me, a revelation that right now it's not about what my family did, it's about what I do. And it's very easy to get so tied up in the history and to adapt that, or to feel like that identity is Gay and I are both very much into genealogy, into family history. And sometimes you reach a point where you're like, why am I spending so much time researching what they did and what their accomplishments were, when I really, we have a short time on this life. It should be about what's the mark we're going to leave on the world. That's where the focus ought to be. Yeah, all of this is background. It's informative. It's interesting. It's fascinating. It's a giant puzzle and all that. But it's really about what's the mark we're going to leave. We always knew that we were going to restore the outbuildings and restore the kitchen. And the conversation that I would have with people was always, what are you going to do with it? What are you going to turn it into? And usually they'd call it a shed in the process, which just showed, complete lack of understanding of what that building was. And we always knew that the only thing we were going to do is restore it to a kitchen quarters, not turn it into a man cave. There's another shed. Building in the county here that they turned it into an outdoor dining room. Yeah, she shed. None of that. We were going to respect it. And there are not many of those buildings still around that are being cared for and that have been restored to their original intent. And a lot of that just has to do with respect for that history.
Right.
Then 2 weeks ago, we had an opportunity. Michael Twitty, who is a James Beard award-winning author and expert in Southern foodways, we connected on Instagram, and he was looking for a place to come cook and to bring some chefs to learn about hearth cooking and so forth. And we connected on Instagram, and within 15 minutes, it was like a done deal. And we had an amazing experience with these eight African-American chefs and scholars of hearth cooking and very knowledgeable about Southern and African-American food ways and so forth, coming and using the kitchen. Not just Gay and I dabbling and learning and teaching ourselves. And then I finally saw, okay, now I know what this building is for.
Right, right. Right, exactly. Let's pause for just a second. Wow, I did.
Sorry, I have a friend who used to say, I would cry at a Walmart grand opening. But this does get to me.
It gets to me too.
It's totally getting to me right now. Sorry. Hang on.
No, but I'm grateful for talking about it.
Right. As am I. All right, I'm just going to get a sip of water. All right.
So from that experience, I think we saw what the purpose of that building is now, that kitchen quarters building. We want to make it available to people who are seriously studying hearth cooking, seriously in studying how kitchen quarters worked, how the enslaved people used them, and so forth. So that's going to be its purpose now, and that makes it feel like we not only restored it and respected it, but now it has a use in the world.
And is it my understanding that you're intending to perhaps add some new grave markers to the cemetery on the property?
Yeah, we definitely need to mark Priscilla Fauntleroy. You know, she was thought enough of to be buried beside the family, but not given a marker. And I posted on Instagram last night something that as I said in that post, it seriously pisses me off. There's a marker just outside the graveyard wall, and it's not a small marker. It's probably 18 inches by 30 inches that was put there in 1910 for a dog.
Wow.
Mm. And it's a marker that every descendant knows about, and anybody who comes here to visit, they always want to see, where's Max Maplemont? Show me Max Maplemont. You know, the family thought enough of that dog to give him a marker, but 25 years prior did not think enough of Priscilla to mark her grave. So it's not right.
It's not right.
So as you became more popular, people felt that they really got to know you. Were there pros and cons to doing your work in the public eye where your blog and the forum had gotten to be so popular?
Absolutely. The website, the journal started to attract media attention. Washington Post did a story, CNN did a story, The Wall Street Journal. There were several magazine articles. So with each one of these, then more and more people would find the website, of course. It was wonderful. That community was really wonderful because we had a lot of people watching our work. And yeah, I was posting on an almost daily basis. Any day that we did work, I would share what we did. And we had people following along and correcting us. Like the first instance that I realized that there was this kind of value was when somebody emailed at that point and said, hey, all that insulation that you put up on that section of the house, it's backwards. You need to flip it over. So we had the wall open from the outside. The siding was off and we're like, okay, hey, the wall's uninsulated. Let's insulate it. So we put it up with the paper, as you normally would from the inside with the paper backing facing out. And they're like, no, that vapor barrier needs to be turned around. So felt like an idiot, but was also extremely appreciative. And the next day was out there flipping it all around. Had lots of recommendations along the way. Alex from Old Town Home,
yes,
who you just released that podcast.
Right.
Yeah, he followed us for a long time. And it's hard to believe, but 16 years ago, he connected me with an Amish woodworker who reproduced a lot of window sashes for us, reproduced a set of double doors, had other people that were recommending a specific molder. So we got a lot of value. We also got a lot of criticism. you know, as is the internet, you know, a lot of people who were very vocal about not agreeing with decisions that we made and so forth, which is a little tough to take when it's your house.
Right. I call those my Instagram direct messages.
Yep. And then we had, there was a wonderful lady that just out of the blue in the mail one day showed up a sampler, a hand-done sampler that she had made for us. Or she kind of explained, I'm always doing needlework, I'm always doing samplers, and said, just wanted y'all to have this. It's a beautiful piece of work and such a nice gesture, and not somebody who had been really engaging in a visible way with us. You know, the downside of it was we're both very private people. And I think that first shocking moment when we were in Richmond at a garden show and heard somebody go, it's the Enon Hall family. Like, whoa. I don't like being recognized in public. But more so, it was people who would just show up at the house who kind of had the perception that this was, since we're putting it all out there on this journal, then that means our doors are open and come on by anytime. And you both know, when you're in the thick of a house project, as we always were, you're not presentable or right. or ready to right. stop your work and conduct a tour. So that was a bit of the downside.
I got recognized in TJ Maxx, I think. I was out in TJ Maxx and somebody recognized me. And Devin, I think I texted you. I know I texted somebody. I was like, oh my gosh, somebody just recognized me in TJ Maxx. Do you remember that, Devin? Was that you I texted?
I do.
Yeah.
Yes.
But then the side effect, the other, you know, the flip side to that is that I also had a couple of people send me direct messages and say, hey, I drove by your house the other day. And that felt a little less good. It didn't feel bad, but it felt a little... just a little more uncomfortable, I guess, than meeting somebody in TJ Maxx.
Yeah, we call them looky-loos. That, you know, you see the vehicle that you don't recognize coming very slowly down the road, and
we have a whole thing in our town. Well, in non-pandemic times, where they have this, it's called reunion weekend, and basically the entire school they come back. Everybody has a combined reunion, everybody who graduated from the high school. And during that weekend, they have a whole bunch of activities planned. And the woman who lived here for years and years and years. So we have a lot of people that drive very slowly by the house during reunion weekend. And it's not because of us. It's because they want to see how the house has changed, what it looks like now, people who are really familiar with the previous owner, Dorothy. But yeah, that's funny. You could always tell when somebody's just interested in kind of getting a view of the house and what it looks like. And I like that. I think that's nice, you know, that they're interested in seeing how the house looks now.
Yeah, absolutely.
What would you say the most unusual stranger encounter you had was related to your notoriety that you never asked for?
I think the most unusual would have to be just being recognized out in public in Richmond and, you know, minding our own business and all of a sudden.
Right. Hello.
Yeah.
We want to just take a minute to thank everyone for supporting True Tales from Old Houses. Over the past few months, your ratings, reviews, and shares on social media have helped spread the word about the show. Please keep doing what you're doing. If you love the show, those are some helpful non-monetary ways to contribute.
So if that level of support is what you can provide, Devin and I have no additional expectations. None. Zero. That's it. We are grateful for the time that you're willing to spend telling others about True Tales from Old Houses, and it really makes a difference. Now, if you do feel like contributing to the overhead costs of producing this show, we welcome your one-time or reoccurring donation. Over on truetalesfromoldhouses.com, there's a donate button right on the sidebar. And if you donate in the $20 to $25 range or more, we'll send you a coffee mug with the True Tales from Old Houses logo on it as a gift of our appreciation.
Thank you so much. Without you, there would be no True Tales from Old Houses.
Let's see. So we'll talk about maybe kids in the construction zone.
I think that's good, yeah.
Okay. Oh, and by the way, his son's William, not David. Although... David just fits. It just sounds so good. I don't know why.
David got fed up and ran away.
I have no idea how I made up that name. And I was so confident, you know? Speak it confidently, right? your son is William. So you and your wife, Gay, raised your son, William, during this whole process. And I was just, did you and Gay have concerns about raising a child in this sort of long-term construction zone?
Yeah, when we first bought the place, we were coming on the weekends. So it was not a full-time residence where he was living all the time. And a lot of the projects that we were doing initially were really revealing, uncovering the old house and cleaning it up and tearing down. If we were doing something that we thought was like there was a time when we were removing asbestos shingles and he wasn't here for that. He was here for uncovering the front walk, which is when we discovered that he's not allergic, or at least wasn't at the time, to poison ivy, because he was basically rolling in it. Didn't come up with it. Gay and I recovered, and William had none. And then when we built the addition, the protracted period where we were basically working on the house for 20 straight months, 7 days a week, we had really segmented the construction zone from where we were living. And we had, you know, this is kind of like two attached houses. And we were able to live in the Dutch colonial, board off the doors that led into the area that was the construction zone. So there was not really an intermingling. We've never done anything here like sanding and removing paint that would be releasing lead. So it's been, you know, a careful process. You know, for him, it was, you know, he was a big history buff from a very young age. And when we would come here on the weekends, lots of times if we didn't have time to do a project, or even while Mr. Hayden was still living here, our favorite thing to do was just come and dig a hole.
Right.
Because you cannot dig a hole anywhere here, well, maybe now you can, without finding something. And the very first hole that we dug, we came up with kind of the, if I was to pick, I hope, I'd be so excited if I could find this. And that's what we found. We dug up a piece of ceramic pipe stem, you know, the old long white clay pipes, tobacco pipes. And the cool thing about pipe stems, they were like cigarette butts from the 18th century and early 19th century. And the size of the bore, the hole in the stem, varied over the years. So you can actually date them based on, take a drill bit, stick it in there, match up the size. And there's a chart developed by Colonial Williamsburg, one of their archaeologists, that'll tell you how old it is. So he got sucked in at an early age to the history, to the discovery. And he was involved in projects when we realized we couldn't pull the old refrigerator out far enough to get behind it to paint because it was boxed in by counters. I just lowered him behind the, it's one of my favorite photos where he's in this little, you know, space of about 12 inches between the back of the refrigerator and the wall with a paint roller. And
send in the little guy, right?
That's right. He always had projects. I can tell you, going back to the stink and stench and nastiness, there were moments when he was overwhelmed. Gay was cleaning out under the stove, and we uncovered a particularly gnarly old mouse nest. And as we were grossing out, I looked out the window, and William was running down the road like Forrest Gump, just running away from the house. Like, okay, well, we've lost William. He's out.
Oh, the visual. I can just see it. Oh, that's hilarious. That's funny.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. Part 2 with Bill will be available on Monday, September 28th. For more information about this episode, including show notes and transcripts, visit the True Tales from Old Houses website.
Until next time.
Bye for now.